Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, filling in for Ann.
It is the worst Ebola outbreak in history, and it continues to wreak havoc across West Africa. The World Health Organization says there have now been at least 660 deaths from the disease since March, and there is no sign of it slowing down.
That was a CNN video and audio from a week ago describing the deadly Ebola outbreak. Since then, the death toll has risen to almost 900, with over 1,600 known cases, according to the World Health Organization. The outbreak is creating havoc not only for inhabitants of the infected countries, but for emergency aid workers on the ground who run the risk of contracting the virus. News of the epidemic has left the rest of the world unsettled, to say the least, and riddled with misinformation. Today on the show, we're looking at the Ebola crisis and the dangers it does and doesn't pose in the U.S. and around the world. Joining us now with an update on the outbreak is New York Times reporter Denise Grady. Denise, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's good to have you here and help us try and gain a little perspective as we alluded to before. There is a lot of concern and misinformation and whatnot going around. So take us back a little bit. Can you remind us when this current outbreak began and where it began?
The outbreak first was made public and really seemed to have been recognized, and the reporting started back in March. But the first cases actually occurred in late December 2013, and they happened in part of Guinea. In the part of Guinea that is very close to the borders with Sierra Leone and Liberia. And there's a lot of movement across the borders in that region, and so the disease very quickly wound up in the other countries, too. And the case count and the death count today is even higher than what was reported the other day. It's now up to 932 people dead and 1,700 cases. New cases still coming up all the time, and everybody in the region who's been dealing with it is saying that it's pretty much out of control.
Is this a case where they've really been able to identify a so-called patient zero?
There is a thought. I don't think anybody is sure, but the first patient listed in one of the scientific reports about it was actually a two-year-old child in Guinea who died. A sibling died. Her mother died. Her grandmother died. They all got sick and then died within just a few days after becoming ill.
You know, I mean, this can be passed from human to human, but where did this Ebola virus originate from, and how did this patient zero likely get it?
You know, that's really the million-dollar question, and nobody knows the answer. The belief is that this virus probably in nature thrives and lives out in bats, although there has not been an identification of which kind of bat. The thinking is that it's probably some kind of a fruit bat. And the bats can then infect people or other animals through their droppings or through, if there are places where people eat bats, if you are killing them and cutting them up and exposed to the blood, you can contract it. But there's also thinking that you could contract it from the droppings on the fruit. Apes can also catch it. It kills them. It doesn't seem to kill the bats. And so people that eat monkeys or ape meat may also become exposed to it. And again, it isn't through eating it, because if you cook the food, you kill the virus. But it's in the killing and cutting and butchering and the exposure to the blood. And that's usually where outbreaks like this are thought to have started. But in this case, nobody seems to know how this child became infected. And someone I talked to yesterday said that when you have an outbreak like this going on, you don't really have time to put the resources back into finding out exactly how patient zero caught it. You know, that's kind of like trying to figure out where the fire started instead of putting it out. So maybe you try to come back and do that later.
Yeah. You know, and of course, you know, we're not talking about a you know, about a modern, up-to-date, nation, such as if we had an outbreak here in the United States where you can swarm it essentially with technology and people like that. We're talking about a fairly remote area of the world.
These are places where the hospitals don't even have running water. Many of them, not all, but many of them don't. And this is so people can't even wash their hands. So it's really tough in these regions to deal with a disease where you need a tremendous hygiene and infection control.
Sanitation is a big deal.
Huge. It is huge.
Yeah. At this point, in what countries have there been confirmed cases?
Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone have really been been the epicenters of the outbreak. Then a case wound up in Nigeria. A man traveled from Liberia to Nigeria and brought it there, and some of the people caring for him contracted it. So right now there have been 9 cases in Nigeria, but that's in comparison to like 500 cases in Guinea, 500 cases in Liberia, and about 700 in Sierra Leone. Sierra Leone seems to have the highest number of cases and highest number of new cases right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At what point did this really start to get the attention of the international media? What set up the red flag?
I think within the last few weeks, people started really paying attention to the fact that the cases were increasing, and also the fact that new cases were coming in from places, villages where they weren't even expecting, didn't even realize the disease had gotten there. So there's a thinking with these outbreaks that if you have all the patients and you can identify their contacts and you know that you've identified all the contacts, then you have a chance of stopping it because you keep track of the contacts and you isolate them if they start getting symptoms. But what they realized in this case was that they were nowhere near that because they were having people come in who were not even on the contact list. We didn't even know this family. We didn't even know that there was a problem in this village. So they were coming in from nowhere. And the contact tracing is really tough. I spoke with a nurse yesterday who had been working in Guinea, and she said on any given day they could have 500 people that they needed to go and check for fever. And when somebody is a contact, you have to check them every day for the incubation period, which is 21 days.
How daunting that must be.
Oh, they are just—it's just overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind our listeners: you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And if you've got a question or a comment during the show that you'd like to ask, please give us a call 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Denise, we're talking with Denise Grady, who is a reporter for the New York Times, who's been covering, this story. How are you had updated us on the number of dead and the number of known cases at this point. How are the numbers of these victims being tallied and reported, and what's the difficulty in just coming up with numbers?
It's a good question, too, and these could easily be underestimates. Because there may be cases out in remote areas that are not even coming to attention. So they're being counted and tallied by the hospitals and the isolation units or treatment centers that have been set up by Doctors Without Borders. So they have really been on the front lines and have a lot of experience and expertise in dealing with outbreaks of diseases, of these hemorrhagic diseases like this. And they set up treatment units and know how to deal with it so that the workers are not getting infected. In the local areas where the local people and some of the other non-governmental groups that have been trying to take care of patients, there have been a lot of healthcare workers infected.
Yeah, and that was going to be my next question. What about keeping the healthcare workers themselves safe? We know that about 60 local healthcare workers have died from the disease, including Sierra Leone's top Ebola doctor, Sheikh Umar Khan. And, of course, we've had two Americans that recently were flown back to the United States and are being treated as well. So with this in mind, you know, especially, you know, since this is something where you come into contact, very close contact with many of the people that are carrying the disease, what are they doing? What precautions are being taken that you know of?
They are suiting up, wearing these, you need to wear these outfits that look like, a spacesuit or a hazmat suit, so that you're covered with some kind of material that doesn't let moisture get through. And the thing that's worth mentioning is that it doesn't spread or hang in the air like flu or TB.
Right.
It really is spread by bodily fluids. So, you know, coming right in contact with the fluids or on things that have contaminated surfaces or needles or things like that. So people need to cover themselves, cover their eyes and their mouths and noses. But the difficulty in these places with this kind of gear is that it's extremely hot. And you put this stuff on and you just feel like you're suffocating. And people wind up drenched in sweat. And they can't keep it on for more than maybe a couple of hours, or they run the risk of fainting or just becoming so lightheaded and miserable that it can be hard to pay attention to how you take it off. And the real danger can be in taking it off the wrong way, because in theory the outside of it may have some contaminant on it. And if you touch it, then you can infect yourself by taking the gear off the wrong way.
That's so the first thing that really struck me when I saw a video of the aid workers was oh my gosh, it must be like being in a sauna, and as you say, you do risk the dangers of dehydration.
The nurse that I spoke with yesterday said that the workers were drinking the kind of rehydration fluids that some of the patients needed, because otherwise you just couldn't function. You couldn't replace everything that you were losing. She said when you take the suit off, you look like somebody had just dumped a bucket of water on you.
Oh my gosh! I really almost can't imagine, you know, what it must be like.
Covered an outbreak similar to this in Angola, and I tried on one of those suits, and I couldn't wait to get it off. I mean, I must have lasted all of about 5 minutes in it, and I felt like I couldn't breathe, and I was overheating. And when I was taking it off, the doctor who was showing me how to do it said, okay, we're going to do this as if you had exposure, and you're going to take it off the right way so that you don't run a risk of infecting yourself. And we went through the whole little drill. And I think about four times I would have contaminated myself.
A couple really quick questions before we take a break here. The head of the World Health Organization met recently with officials from the infected countries. Do you know anything about how that meeting went or what came out of it?
I know that there have been a lot of discussion and promises made about getting more supplies and more people on the ground there. I think there's a general recognition that this was underestimated, and the initial response was just not adequate. Doctors Without Borders has been saying that all along, and everybody seems to recognize that they've got to get more people and more equipment into the region.
Now, we had a woman who tested negative for Ebola virus yesterday in Columbus, and there's a patient in a New York hospital who had symptoms of Ebola. Are officials worried here in the U.S. that it might spread here?
I think that people who understand this are really not worried that it will spread if it gets here. I think everybody acknowledges there's a possibility that it could get here. But the general feeling is that infection control here is really good, and that if somebody was infected, the standard procedures here would catch it and contain it pretty fast. So, and a number of places are having these kind of scares now, and in some sense you can say that it's actually a good sign that the system is working, because the hospitals are on very high alert for anybody who's traveled in that part of the world and comes back with a fever. Mm-hmm.
Denise O'Grady is a New York Times reporter who's been covering the Ebola outbreak. And Denise, we're going to take a break, but before we let you go, I want to say thank you very much for joining us, because I think that really helps our audience gain a lot of perspective on what's going on and maybe addressing some of their concerns.
My pleasure.
You bet. Thanks again, Denise. And this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, filling in for Ann this week. Two American aid workers are back in the United States seeking treatment after contracting the Ebola virus in Liberia. They are two of the more than 1,600 cases of the virus that have broken out in West Africa since March. And if you were listening during the first part of our show, that death toll has actually risen to 932 dead, reported, in the zones where this disease is occurring. The reentry of these aid workers into the United States has stirred up worry over the chances of a potential outbreak on American soil. But experts are maintaining that the risk of that is very low. One such expert is a professor of infectious diseases and preventative medicine at Vanderbilt University and an advisor to the World Health Organization. He joins us on the phone from Nashville. Welcome, Dr. William Schaffner.
Well, good morning, Stu. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you here, because this is something that's been in the news, as we were talking with Denise Grady from the New York Times earlier. This certainly is a story that is subject to a lot of information overload and even to some degree misinformation. So it's a good chance to gain some perspective with you. Let's talk about those aid workers that were brought back. Denise talked about the layers of protective gear that they have to wear and how difficult it is to wear, and they can only wear it for maybe a couple of hours maximum in that heat and humidity. So how do we think these two workers contracted the disease?
Well, obviously there must have been some event, some occasion, where the body fluids containing the virus of patients for whom they were caring actually found their way onto or into both of those people, despite everything that they were trying to do in those manifestly difficult circumstances. And those circumstances are much more difficult than what the folks at the Emory Hospital or any other hospital here, while we are doing infection control, have to contend with. Among other things, we work in a comfortably air-conditioned environment, and that makes it much, much more easy for us to do that.
It's called Ebola hemorrhagic fever. What exactly does that mean?
It means that the virus, this is a virus that once it gets into you, tries to infect many cells in your body. And among the ones it targets are the cells lining the blood vessels. And if it gets into those cells and begins to cause damage, it actually disrupts the cells. We begin to then bleed, and we can suddenly have nosebleeds. We start bleeding around our gums. We can bleed into the whites of our eyes, perhaps have some bleeding in our bowel movements, and we can bleed into the skin. You get hemorrhages into the skin. And that cascades into a clotting disorder, so our blood does not clot as well either. Hence, hemorrhagic fever.
So when you get somebody that's started to exhibit those symptoms, I mean, it sounds like it can happen in very rapid fashion.
Actually, it's not quite that fast. The onset of illness is abrupt, with high fever, headache, feeling poorly, loss of appetite. Sounds like a really bad case of the flu. And then once it's recognized and you're taking care of the patient, the virus kind of marches through your body and progressively can disrupt the function of particularly your liver, sometimes your kidneys, and then other bodily functions. You can get a rash, and this can take a matter of days usually. So these patients actually require a substantial amount of supportive care over a somewhat prolonged period of time, of course, increasing the risk to the healthcare workers.
I remember being a former reporter talking with EMTs and people like that, saying they always talk about that golden hour in responding to an emergency. So what's the equivalent when you're talking about an Ebola patient? Since maybe the onset is quick, but it sounds like you've got a window there that where if you get to it early enough, you can at least lessen the damage or even bring them back to health.
Yeah, so two things about that. One is we obviously wish to care for the patient, and the crux of care is supportive care. Since we don't have a licensed medication that we can give that fights the actual Ebola virus, what we try to do is support the body while it fights and rids itself of the infection. So the earlier we can put that supportive system into place, the better. There's another item. The earlier we can identify that patient, that sick and now contagious patient can be removed from their family circumstance and put into a healthcare circumstance. If we can get them out of the family quick, then there's less risk, of course, of transmitting the virus to family members were the patient to stay home and the family members care for that patient.
Denise Grady from the New York Times was telling us too, from her experience both over there and in covering the story, that just even the hospitals it's difficult for them to do a lot of what you're talking about.
That's undoubtedly correct. My friend Denise has been there, and so she has seen this vividly recently. Her stories and others illustrate how difficult it is for hospitals with limited resources, and also at home trying to quarantine patients. Things are really much more lax in Africa than they are here. And I agree with Denise that good community hospitals across the country, as they are demonstrating now in medical centers such as my own here at Vanderbilt, were such patients to come to us, candidate patients, while we're diagnosing them. Our infection control training and procedures and facilities are quite adequate to take care of those patients well and to take care of them safely, for the healthcare workers' family, and certainly the general community.
Is this almost a situation where perhaps a treatment center needs to be set up in, maybe a neighboring country or someplace relatively close by that can be secured, that can be set up to give this kind of proper care, or is that even possible?
I think what you'd like to do is establish rigorous procedures throughout the three affected countries in centers where numerous centers relatively close to home where they can take care of patients very well. And that's why the World Health Organization, Doctors Without Borders, the CDC are all going to be involved to try to beef up what it is, make more rigorous what it is that the local folks can do, and to try to really get everybody on the same page.
We're talking with Dr. William Schaffner, who's a professor of infectious diseases and preventative medicine at Vanderbilt University and an advisor to the World Health Organization. And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And we invite you to call in with a question or a comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Schaffner, let's talk for a bit about the two American aid workers that have just been brought back into the United States and are being treated right now. I'm reading in the paper this morning that they're both being treated with a serum. They're identifying it as something called ZMAP, which is a treatment based on serum taken from lab animals that have been given the Ebola virus and somehow apparently also involves the use of tobacco. Do you know much about this?
Yeah, let me modify the concept a little bit.
Sure.
First, a little bit of background. Let's take an illness like measles. Someone gets measles, gets the measles infection. The body develops antibodies, which then rid us of the measles virus. We then have those antibodies in us, and should we encounter the measles virus a second time, those antibodies are in place and will eliminate the measles virus so we don't get measles a second time. So these antibodies are powerful. They fight the virus. Mm-hmm. We can create artificial antibodies using what's called molecular biological techniques, monoclonal antibodies, and these antibodies have been raised in mice and put into plasma, and that plasma has then been infused into these two people. These are the first two human beings who've received this medication, which has only been used in a small number of monkeys before to test how effective it might be. So this is very experimental and would never have been done except for these extraordinary circumstances.
Are you optimistic? I mean, we're hearing that at least one of the patients, Dr. Kent Brandley, seems to be showing signs of improvement. I mean, we don't want to build up expectations, but what's your take on what's going on as far as the results?
Yeah, here's the scientific conundrum. Would they have gotten better without the serum? And that's, of course, why we do clinical trials. When you don't know, you recruit volunteers with the illness, half of whom get the treatment, half of whom don't get the treatment, or they get a placebo, and then you see how things work out down the road. Do the people who get the treatment really do better, and how much better, and in which regard, than the folks who don't? If we just look at anecdotes, we'll be wondering about what the role of the treatment actually was in the improvement when they were kind of on the road to improvement maybe already. So we'll look at that very carefully, and I hope what all this does is catalyze clinical trials going into the future, because the last thing you want to do is start using a, quote, treatment that doesn't work very well or has bad side effects.
And I guess that was going to be my next question: is at what point do you take a treatment like this, and bring it into the zone where the disease is so prevalent right now? I
mean, yeah, that's a very tough question. First of all, does the small biopharmaceutical firm have the capacity to really notch up and produce this monoclonal antibody concoction in quantity? Number two, there have been since we were doing AIDS treatments, there have been sensitive ethical issues concerning informed consent in the developing world. So you have to create an environment so that the people who are going to receive the treatment, the experimental treatment, have a chance to understand what's happening and agree to it. Our two Americans were completely cognizant, and they gave their informed consent. Mm-hmm. Not so easy when you're doing something that's transcultural and where there are large educational gaps.
And languages and dialects and all kinds of opportunities for trying to get people to understand correctly, and indeed it may be very difficult for them to understand.
And on and on. You have characterized it very, very well. This is not easy, and we must respect their independence and their need to be informed.
You had talked earlier, and we had a caller that called in a little bit earlier, just kind of left us a message with a question in it. And you had talked earlier about getting the measles, and once you have it and get through it, your body builds up antibodies. Is that also the same case with Ebola? I mean, if you get Ebola, can you get it again, or develop that immunity?
It's a more complicated infection, but our general thought is that once you have recovered from Ebola, you ought to be protected against subsequent infection. But that has not been carefully studied, as you can imagine, because prior to this, Ebola was rare. It was focal, usually in remote villages, so it could be quickly contained. The big difference with this Ebola outbreak is that it's gotten into urban areas where the possibilities for spread, for misinformation, difficulties in tracking down patients and their contacts are much greater, hence the much more widespread nature of this epidemic.
And I guess here's the big question that I think a lot of people are asking. What is the likelihood of this becoming a worldwide epidemic?
Don't think it has any likelihood at all. Clearly, with these infections, you could have export infections to neighboring countries. That's the major concern in Africa now. Could it spread to Nigeria, for example, and other countries that are in that neighborhood in West Africa? There will be, on occasion, people who come from West Africa, possibly exposed, now with symptoms, who are admitted to hospitals in Europe and Australia and the United States and Canada.
And we had one happen here in Columbus just yesterday.
See? But our institutions can manage that, and Ebola will not establish itself in this hemisphere.
And we should point out that the person that was brought into a hospital here in Columbus was found not to have Ebola, although this person had visited West Africa and started to exhibit some of the symptoms. But the blood tests apparently showed that this patient did not have it. So it's a really good point. Let me ask you finally, doctor, before we go to a break. You know, public information is essential in a situation like this, whether it's over in the zone in Africa or here in the United States. How would you characterize that effort at this point from where you sit? Is, you know, good? Could it be better? Could, you know, what, how would you rate it at this point?
Well, Stu, I'm just so pleased that we're having this conversation so your listeners can digest the information kind of in a low-key fashion. I think the coverage of the outbreak and introductions back into the United States has been thorough, but it's been a bit anxious, don't you know, mm-hmm. as TV tends to do that. If you take the time to read Denise Grady's pieces in the New York Times and her colleagues, if you take the time to actually read things and listen carefully, the information is there. It's a bit hyped. And frankly, we in public health and infectious diseases have been a little taken aback that there's been quite so much anxiety about this. Similar hemorrhagic infections have been introduced a couple of times in the United States and more often than that into the UK. And in the UK and previously here in the US, it's all been rather humdrum. We've taken care of these patients very well. Mm-hmm. But this time, I think because the outbreak is uncontrolled in Africa, there's been more anxiety.
Yeah. Dr. William Schaffner is the professor of infectious diseases and preventative medicine at Vanderbilt University and an advisor to the World Health Organization. Doctor, we want to thank you very much for joining us this morning. I mean, you've really helped us again gain that kind of perspective, and I'm sure our listeners will appreciate that. And doctor, thank you very much.
It's been good being with you, Stu. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, sitting in for Ann this week. The Ebola outbreak in West Africa has now claimed over 900 lives. Victims are experiencing bleeding, vomiting, diarrhea, and eventually die of organ failure if left untreated. Without question, it is somewhat of a medical nightmare, but this epidemic is especially deadly due to some of the political nightmares that plague the region. Even without an infectious virus, the affected countries are some of the most unstable in the world. But when faced with Ebola, some aid organizations are pulling volunteers from the ground. Joining us on the phone from Northampton, Massachusetts, is an assistant professor of government and African politics at Smith College. She recently wrote an article in the Washington Post about West Africa's struggle to respond to the crisis. Kimmy Dion, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. And also joining us is a Peace Corps volunteer just back from Sierra Leone, where her training was interrupted due to the outbreak. Molly Bachman, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here, and I'm looking forward to how both of you can perhaps put this, you know, in some perspective and give us an indication from what's been happening on the ground out there. Kim, you wrote that years of civil war have basically decimated the health infrastructure in Sierra Leone and Liberia. Tell us about that and what the effects have been.
Sure. I mean, if you read any of the reports on the healthcare infrastructure in Sierra Leone and in Liberia, and also actually in Guinea, even though it hadn't suffered from civil war in the recent years, that their healthcare infrastructure is supremely lacking. Not just in terms of the number of clinics available or drugs available within these clinics, but also in the incredible healthcare worker shortage that is faced in all three countries.
And our prior guests have both talked about the fact that it is extremely difficult for healthcare workers over there, having to wear, you know, protective suits and only being able to wear those for a couple of hours at most at the time. So the conditions certainly seem to have a huge effect on that.
Sure, but there are also reports not just that of the challenges of working in protective equipment, but the fact that there's very little protective equipment available. So you'll hear about, for example, some reports of nurses that are going on strike in some of these countries because they're unwilling to work in conditions where they're not being properly protected. And it's really important that we think about the frontline healthcare workers who are responding to the disease because, as we know, they're the ones at greatest risk of infection. And so if the resources aren't available on the ground to provide Liberian, Sierra Leonean, and Guinean nurses and doctors with the equipment that they need to protect themselves from infection, then, you know, it's going to further complicate the response.
And I think the number
because we won't have healthcare workers to respond.
And I think I've heard the number is somewhere in the area of around 60 to 70 healthcare workers, native healthcare workers that have died as a result of the disease.
Right. Some of the best estimates that I've seen are that 8% of the fatalities in the current Ebola outbreak are of healthcare workers.
Mm-hmm. How, you know, from where you sit and from what you've seen, how are national and local governments responding to the crisis? How well are they doing it? And did they respond quickly enough?
Definitely, the initial response was slow. And shortly thereafter, they started to see fatalities lowering. And so the idea is that maybe they relaxed their response a little too early, and then you see a large uptick in fatalities. And so it was following that large uptick and the infections of some prominent doctors, including the two Americans, of course, and the Liberian-American man who had traveled to Nigeria, that brought greater attention to the disease. So we didn't see a response. We didn't see an international meeting about the outbreak and its response until early July, even though the outbreak started in March. So there was delay, and I would say that delay is somewhat due to the poor response by local governments, but also due to poor response by the World Health Organization as well.
We're speaking with Kimmy Dion, who's an assistant professor of government and African politics at Smith College and who recently wrote an article in the Washington Post about West Africa's struggle to respond to the Ebola crisis. And somebody who was on the ground in Sierra Leone is with us in the studio. Molly Bachman is a Peace Corps volunteer. Molly, you know, being in Sierra Leone recently, and of course you were among those who were essentially evacuated, from the zone. Tell us what you were doing there.
So every Peace Corps volunteer, regardless of which country you serve in, is required to go through about 3 months of training. So I had left for Sierra Leone on June 16th and had completed about 7 weeks of training before we were required to leave Sierra Leone.
And how did you get the word? How did you find out that your training was going to essentially be cut very short?
So actually a week ago today on Wednesday, we were notified by our program director that we were going to be temporarily leaving Sierra Leone. We weren't sure exactly what time we were going to be leaving, but that this was the situation with Ebola. It is we want to mitigate the risk. We want to be vigilant about our health and our safety, and we want to avoid any problems. So then Thursday we found out that we would be evacuating the country.
Did you know that about the outbreak, before you left to go there?
Absolutely. I think every volunteer in my group was made full aware of the situation. We knew the risks going in, and we felt that it was almost worth the risk because we were going to be educators. We would be an avenue to help maybe stop this. So we knew what was happening all along. And during our training, we were constantly being updated with the statistics, with the virus itself, exactly how it travels throughout people, the cultural implications. So we were well informed throughout our entire time being there.
How would you describe the reaction of people on the ground, the residents that you came into contact with?
Yeah. So I'd say I experienced a variety of reactions. We each stay with a homestay family. And one evening, a reverend came to stay at my homestay family with me. And I remember sitting on the porch talking with him about Ebola. And some of the things he would say is that, this is a virus that the Timni people had created and only Mende people can get it. And that was really shocking to me because that's the furthest thing from the truth. And I'm really lucky that my family is well-informed and they stood up and said, but sir, how can you explain the virus in Guinea and Liberia? So there's lots of dialogue. There's lots of conversation. Walking around, you can see posters advertising a movie that talks about Ebola. There's a very popular song right now talking about Ebola and the ways that it's transmitted. So there's lots of dialogue, lots of conversation. I was in Bo, the second largest city. So there's a lot more education and a lot more educated people there. Whereas in villages, maybe that's not the case.
Kim, let me go to you as well. I mean, listening to what Molly has had to say, how does that square with what you're seeing and what you're hearing?
I think I like her characterization of what she's seen and heard, and it fits well with what my own impressions are of what's going on. There's been a lot of sensational accounts, including by leading public health analysts about the dynamics of the disease and local cultural understandings of it, and I think that some of those are a bit overblown. I think that it's a relatively new disease in this region of the world, right? So particularly in West Africa, this is the first outbreak that was recorded of Ebola, and so anytime a population is dealing with a new health scare, they're going to respond to it with a bit of fear and maybe some mistrust. I mean, look, for example, at the way Americans are responding. You have famous reality television stars, talking about Ebola like we are actually in America at risk when in fact we're not. Mm-hmm. But it's because it's not something that we as Americans have experienced. And so the thing about Ebola is that some of the symptoms that one can get when infected with Ebola are similar to other neglected tropical diseases that are endemic in those regions. So, one could think that you have malaria, but of course. course, we know Ebola is different, right? It's incredibly fatal, and that makes it scary. And so, people, you know, some of these accounts that we're reading in the Western media are really focusing on the fear that some people have, and I think that we all need to remember that even here in the U.S., you know, we have some pretty unsubstantiated fears, and we're reacting also in some not terribly responsible ways. But there are plenty of people who, you know, are navigating the epidemic themselves that are mindful of what's going on, and even though they are experiencing something new and something that's very scary, they're going about it in a way that's hopefully going to stem the epidemic in the coming months.
Molly, let me ask you, when you were over there, did you notice any mistrust of officials or modern health practices, as the officials tried to get the word out about Ebola and what it is and what it isn't?
I never personally experienced that or was witness to any mistrust. I do know that it exists simply from what other volunteers have told me based on their experiences. Mm-hmm. But again, I was in a much larger city where information is much more accessible, where people are much more educated. Mm-hmm. And again, that's not necessarily true in villages where they don't have access to information nor access to adequate medical care.
And as you said earlier, I mean, you did at least, you know, see some of this, some of the misinformation that goes around regarding this.
Exactly.
Kim, it struck me as you were just responding to, you know, just a little while ago, you've studied the AIDS epidemic in Africa. How does this bear any resemblance to the AIDS crisis when that was, you know, kind of at the, you know, maybe perhaps at the same stage that we're seeing with Ebola, as far as the stigma, cultural taboos, things like that? Tell us what you're seeing and what you're hearing.
Sure. I think, you know, what I've read so far of what's been happening in West Africa and in terms of local responses to the disease, it's actually quite similar to initial local responses to AIDS in various parts of Africa. So, you know, usually when there's a new disease, you don't necessarily see it as something new. You know, you interpret it as something similar or in fact, an existing disease. So when people first saw AIDS in, say, East Africa, you know, they didn't give it a new name. It wasn't a new disease. It was a disease that was affecting maybe more people, but they were interpreting it as, you know, if you had transgressed some of these social taboos, you were likely to catch this disease. And you know, the understandings of AIDS early on, people knew that it was sexually transmitted. They may not have called it a sexually transmitted infection, but they could do social autopsies of people saying, well, he got sick after he slept with so-and-so. So there was this, you know, even absent kind of an international response to educate people about how HIV was transmitted, there were already local understandings because people, you know, they live among each other. They know how other people move. And I think that you're seeing some of that with Ebola, right? So that some people are saying, well, she cared for someone who was dying. So, you know, I think we're also going to be seeing, you know, some of the initial, because again, it's a scary disease, it's a relatively new experience in this region, people are going to say, well, she cared for someone who died, so she's probably sick. And that's a natural way to think about it, right? I mean, here in the States, you know, if anyone shows up with a fever and diarrhea, we're like, well, if they've been to Liberia, we should put them in isolation, because that's what we do. We protect ourselves and we think about what the possibilities are. And I think that locally, people are starting to understand that as well, right? You cared for someone who died. You know, maybe you yourself are sick.
And it's certainly a subject where we could really discuss this at length. But what you've brought to the table to us, Kim and Molly, again, really, we thank you very much for joining us, because you really helped us gain a lot of perspective on this, and hopefully our listeners as well. Kim, let me thank you very much. Molly, thank you for joining us as well. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.